Welcome to the Backend Engineering Show with your host, Hussein Nasser. This is the show where we discuss the art and the craft of building software and cover recent news on backend technologies. If you enjoy the show, make sure to subscribe to the YouTube channel and rate it on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. With that said, let's get on the show.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
How's everybody doing this beautiful Saturday? What's up? How's everybody doing? So yeah, the theme today is about TLS. That stands for Transport Layer Security. So anything security, you're going to talk about security of the web, security of the transport, security of encryption, symmetric, asymmetric encryption. Osama says, I'm really excited about the WebRTC video. Oh, man, I am really pumped about the WebRTC video, guys. So the WebRTC, man, this is a technology I've been researching for almost now 2 years. On and off, obviously. But WebRTC is not... If you search for the WebRTC, it's almost like a dead technology. Nobody talks about it anymore. The only good video is from 7 years ago from Google. Nobody talks about it. I mean, there is the occasional... Oh, let's build a WhatsApp using WebRTC clone. I don't know what with WebRTC clone. They don't discuss the technology. They just literally pick a library that does everything for them. And this channel, we try to open the box and look at it. And the box is scary. It's a Pandora's box. That's what we try to do. We try to understand. We try to ask why. So yeah, I'm working on the WebRTC videos. Maybe it's going to take another week. It's just research takes time. Because I have questions. And these questions, you guys don't see it, but I ask myself this question and I try to answer it. And the process of searching for these questions takes time. Because it doesn't really just yell at you, hey, this is the answer. No, you have to find it out, right? So... I don't think people really dive deep into the technology to really understand. There is a very, very, very few people who understand this technology, in my opinion, because of the breadth of the stuff it touches. It's not just programming. There's the API, obviously, which the front end people deal with. I get media stream, whatever it's called, and then create the connection. And there's the ICE candidate. There's so much stuff. The networking. If you're a network engineer, you're gonna love this technology because they're doing so much behind the scene. And there's the NAT traversal. And there's a stun server, right? It's just signaling concepts and then turn servers and how is the optimal path to communicate between two. So yeah, I'm enjoying doing the WebRTC. The video on Envoy helped me. Thanks. I'm glad it did, Yash. Appreciate it. Greetings from Kerala, India. Thanks, Jitin. Thanks for being a long-term sub and supporter of this channel. Yeah. We're going to start soon, guys. This is just chatting. We're going to just chat. No, our each other a little bit. And then, what are you guys up to? What are you building? What are you writing? Whether software or not. Or novel. or poetry? What do you do? Have you ever used Vitess? I did not. I know about it. I have not used it. I know how it works. It's a pretty neat tech. So Vitess is, for those who don't know, it's a software that allows you to scale MySQL instances and does partitioning without the client being aware of those partitions. When I say partition, I mean really sharding, right? Because partitioning, databases do partitioning without you being need to aware. But sharding, really multiple instances, that's Vitess right there. Because when you do sharding, I made a video about sharding. Check out the video right there. I think it's right here, yes. Check it out. Sharding video. We talked about that and my database, my Udemy Introduction to Database Engineering discusses that in details as well. What is the plan to start software development? Just do it. Don't maybe read a book or two and just start writing code. Ask questions. Ask a lot of questions. If you're just starting, just you have to ask a lot of questions because you're going to have questions. And these questions are going to be confusing for you. And don't feel embarrassed that your questions are stupid or dumb. No, there are no dumb questions. It's just like my professor used to say. If you have a question, 99%, I forgot the percentage, but say 99% that a lot of people have the same exact question in the class, but they are just afraid to ask. Currently working on Electron.js project. Do you have experience in Electron? I wrote one app in Electron. I love it. Yeah, anything that uses JavaScript, I like JavaScript, except frameworks. Sorry. But yeah, Electron is a good app that allows you to write desktop apps using JavaScript that runs everywhere. I love it. So Electron is the front end to me. Is a front end Node.js, almost like that, where Node.js is a back end most of the time, right? Electron is what the user directly interact with immediately. That's what Electron is. Node.js is something the front end interact with. Mac versus PC. I used to work with PC, and now I started using Mac, and I don't think I'm going back to Windows. It's just, I don't know. Just Apple has this idea to suck you in into their ecosystem, and they're doing it really well, right? Like if I have my iPhone right here, right, and if I want to send something to my Mac, that's it, done. Literally, you're gonna tell me, oh, in Windows, just install this and enable this and enable this and do this and do this and do this, and you're gonna be able to do it. Sure, but why? The barrier to entry to do stuff in Mac is zero, almost, right? Any live stream on Kubernetes, you mean? Oh, yeah, I don't know anything about Kubernetes, to be honest. So I'm not confident enough to talk about Kubernetes unless I start researching it, and I have not. Because guess what? There are so much other cool stuff that are not hyped by the media, right? Because Kubernetes is very, very hyped, overhyped. Right, and I don't go for stuff that are just overhyped. I try to first understand the pieces that build this technology, and I'm not there yet. So one of the basic important pieces is container management, and I want to learn more about how containers work under the hood before I jump into that. I know that the abstraction of it, obviously, like a lot of people do, but I want to know more about that before I jump into actually explaining the Kubernetes platform. Is that a sword behind you? Yes. Yes, that's a wooden katana sword. I used to collect them. I like Japanese culture in general, as you can see from the background. Where do you live? I live in a city in Southern California called Temecula. Any video on compiler? How could convert into binary code? Yeah, that's the thing about software engineering. I don't know much about compilers, so I don't have any videos about it. But if I decided to go into it, I'll have to do research and do that. One of my colleagues at work is an expert in compilers. He took his PhD in compilers and programming languages, and man, he's so smart. When he talks, when he tries to solve any problem that we in a meeting, he always thinks like a almost like a compiler and languages and semantics. It's just nuts. It's a completely different world. Do you play games on daily basis? Almost on daily basis, yes. I have to unwind. I mean, guys, you do see me publishing content and doing all that sort of things and producing software engineering, but that's not what I do all the time. I sometimes need to unwind. And one of my hobbies is to play video games, and there are certain amount of games. To me, a video game is a good video game is has the factor of replayability. How often can I replay this game years after it comes back and still enjoy it? That's what I so I play the same games over and over again instead of purchasing and getting new games, unless if it's from great publishers, right? So it's exactly like books. So I didn't read 1,000 books. I read maybe 60, 70 books in my whole life so far, maybe a little bit more than that. But I reread those books to pick up stuff that I missed. I think there are so much knowledge buried in these books, and you need to reread them again. So not quantity, it's quality if you want. So I'm drinking Peru today. Coffee from Peru, beautiful. So yeah, games, I play Skyrim, I still play it. Skyrim, the original one, or I don't know what it's called, the Elder Scroll. The popular one, the one they ported to everywhere. So I like to play it because I like to play as an archer, as a mage. You can play it differently, right? And just you discover new things. I play Deus Ex, Mankind Divided, Human Revolution. I play Dark Souls 1, 2, 3, Sekiro, Bloodborne. These are my favorite kind of games that I could go back and play. So these kind of games, God of War. So yeah. Suggest on best quick way to learn web development. There's nothing quick about anything, to be honest. So I don't have a quick way to learn anything. But there is a guaranteed way, and that's just literally doing it and then being curious of having the humility to ask questions and having humility that you don't know anything and you don't know everything and ask how this works. So that's the idea, is just to keep doing and keep writing code and keep exploring. And if something works without you knowing, that's a red flag. You have, as an engineer, you have the responsibility to know what broke. If something works or if something doesn't work, you have to actually get into the meat and potato and try to understand it. Sometimes you don't. Like sometimes the app restarts and the problem goes away. There are millions of reasons why this could be, right? But sometimes if it's within your area and it's consistently reproducible, then you should ask these questions. Hi from Ukraine. Hey, everybody. Man, you're savage. I can't imagine how you keep this up. So much content produced. Hats off. Thank you, Felipe. I appreciate it, and thank you for becoming a member. Yeah, I mean, again, the idea here is you have to do these kind of things and produce content that you're passionate about, and it's gonna show in the final product. And it shows in my, because I don't make video because something is popular, right? Because if I make a video about something that everything is popular, that happened to be popular in the software engineering, then I'm gonna burn out really, because I'll be chasing my own tail. No, I just try to go back to the first principle, fundamental, and just enjoy. And you get really nice feeling when you learn something. Do you think Kubernetes is overhyped? Definitely, yes. It's overhyped. Kubernetes is overhyped. Service mesh is overhyped. once you understand, it's not a bad technology at all, but I think it's overhyped that people start picking it up and implementing it without really understanding why they pick it up. That's wrong. Greetings from Italy. We have people from Italy. See ya. What are your views on Django? It's a back-end framework, I think, right? It's for Python. Yeah, nothing wrong with that. I mean, again, you can pick any language to build a back-end. And like Node.js, right? Node.js is a back-end, right? It's a framework to a certain extent that helps you build code for the back-end. Not necessarily. You can build scripts with Node.js that executes. But the idea here is, can you use a framework that simplifies your job? And Django is just one of them. My beef with people using framework is they're using a framework without knowing how those frameworks work. And I'm against that. So I use Express, not just because I know exactly what Express do behind the scenes. Because I can build something similar to Express using pure Node.js HTTP library, right? Once you do that, once you understand, and Brad Traversy had a great video showing how to build a backend without Express. It's just pure HTTP library. That's what people need to understand, right? I recommend you checking out that video. Brad Traversy is a great YouTuber. In the software engineer, we really need more people like that guy. So again, Node.js is not a back end; it is an environment. Yeah, I agree with you. I agree with you, Aman. Thank you for that. So it's not really a back end. That's true. It's not really for the back end. You can put it in the front end as well to execute like script. Like you can put it in Jenkins and have Jenkins run a Node.js script that I don't know build something or. Writes to disk. That's not back end. That's front end, I guess. What would be an alternative to Kubernetes? Alternative to Kubernetes is to build your own scripts that orchestrate your containers, right? Because that's what Kubernetes does. It scales your containers because spinning containers is so easy. That means people will spin more and more containers, and you're going to end up with a lot of containers, especially in a microservices environment. This will double and double and double in size, and managing this number of containers becomes really a hassle between hosts on different machines, right? Because you don't put all your containers in one machine. That's just useless. So, do you use SQL? Of course, daily basis, SQL. Hello from Germany. Hello, Freya Master. What are you from? I'm from Bahrain originally. I moved to the States 5 years ago. What reviews or Firebase? Yeah, these are all good tools. I mean, you can use the tools to help you guys. All right, guys. I think we can jump and start. We've been 20 minutes into the stream and discussing good questions and chat. So how about we jump into this topic of the day? TLS. Security. Let me turn my phone off and discuss this thing. And I'm going to make the stream a little bit short today because I have things to get to. But let me know, guys, in the chat if you would like to do a stream just Q&A because you guys seem to enjoy it. You have a lot of questions, and we can have just a Q&A without a theme. Would you be interested in a pure Q&A live stream? That probably will not be something that makes the podcast. It will be just something that will be unlisted probably in the channel. So would you like a chatting Q&A. Let me know. Nice. Yes, definitely. Awesome. All right, guys. So how about we start? We're going to start with TLS. With everything that we discuss, guys, when we build a technology, there is always a reason for it. And once you ask the why, things start to make sense because TLS is a technology. Why did we build it? To solve a problem. What's the problem? Communicating between two parties. I want to send an information from this node to this node, whether this is an RPC call or whether this is a server client architecture where the server is an HTTP server and the client is an HTTP client, a browser. You want to send information and you want to get it back, right? However, if we understand just the pure HTTP protocol, knowing no encryption, nothing, this is the HTTP :// what really happens when we go to google.com unencrypted, assume there is no encryption? And that's what happened in the 90s and before that. Nothing was encrypted, literally nothing. Nobody encrypts anything in the web. So what's the problem if I send things that are unencrypted? If I communicate and send that, try to send information, what happened first? First of all, well, I need a TCP connection, right? This is that logical connection that we're going to use to send packets. So that's the first thing I do. Send, SYNAC, and ACK. And just like that, I have a physical connection. But in order to form this connection, my connection is passing through tens of maybe hundreds of nodes to get to the final destination. That's how the internet works, right? And the basic principle of this is, let's say you have a router. Let's talk about this. This is important. You have a router and you have your Mac and your iPhone, and they are connected through Wi-Fi to this router. So you are kind of you're almost like a mesh connection here to the router. So if you want to send information to Google, it has to go through your router because your router translates your request from your private network, your NATed network, network address translation, from your private IP address, which is 10.0.0.2 or 192.168.1.3, which is nobody understands outside the internet, right? It translates that to a public-facing IP address, and it keeps track. It says, okay, Hussein wants to go to Google, but his IP address is private, so I'm going to add an entry saying that this IP address, 192.168.1.2, wants to go to Google, whatever, 4321 public IP address, through this port 80, that's the unsecure port of HTTP. And in the local side of things, there is also a random port that we generate at the client side. And that helps us do the mapping. So the router says, okay, you can go out naked like this using your private IP address. So let me help you and put a public IP address. So the router will use its public IP address because your router does, right? Quote unquote, there are some exception to that. But your router puts a public IP address and then it changes the packet. So its source is itself, the public IP address, and then sends it to Google. And then this operation happens a lot of time, all the time, the same operation, right? So the router has also another router, right? Because it has another gateway. We call this a gateway. So the router, your router is just another node with your neighbor and other neighbors and other neighbors and other people in the same ISP. And that also communicates to the ISP's probably router. And then that does exactly what we did. Okay, you cannot go out naked like this. Let me translate this, right? If that public IP address was actually essentially private, not completely public. So we'll start doing the same thing, doing NATs if necessary, until it reaches the final destination. So you can see that we're passing through a lot of hops to get to the final destination, right? Because we're doing NATs, we're checking the validity of the packet. Some routers do check the validity of the packet. Says, wait a second, this doesn't look like a TCP send packet. bam, drop it. Some people do that. Some routers do that. So that's one the main reason. All right. So when people say, oh, someone in the middle can sniff your packet, that's what it means. Those nodes in the middle. Does that mean your neighbor that is using your iPhone, your packets go through to him or her? No, that doesn't how that's not how it works. We're just most of the time your ISP gets all the packets, everything goes through your ISP. So people want encryption. So we agree that we need encryption between two parties. All right. So that's the first point. We to communicate between two things, we need to encrypt them to encrypt the communication. That's the need of TLS. Montreal Peg, thanks for your knowledge. Appreciate it. Thank you for the $10 super chat. I'm glad you guys enjoy the content. I'm really, really happy. That's the most important thing, right? And this is a message to you guys. If you know something and if you're in the process of learning something, consider sharing it with other people, because you have no idea what your piece of article, what your piece of blog, what your piece of podcast, what a piece of video, what a piece of poetry, what a piece of music that you write and compose, sculpture, anything, art that you create, you have no idea how it can impact others and change their how they perceive the world, and they can be more productive as a result, right? Yes, DNS is also unencrypted. So we can go through that, all of that stuff, guys. But that will take 2 hours. I had a video called What Happens When You Type Google.com and Hit Enter. It's around 40 minutes, I believe. Exactly showing you with slides, with detailed explanation, what happens the moment you type Google.com and you hit Enter, from DNS, from HSTS, from security, from TLS, from redirection, all of that stuff, from sending the packet to your router, the router sending it to the ISP, and the ISP sending it to the internet, and how it just navigates, shortest path, all of that stuff. So, yeah, consider sharing your knowledge, guys. All right, so that's, we know why we need encryption, because we don't want people snooping between. That's one reason. Other reason of why we need encryption is something that is kind of something unfortunate that happens in the internet. In the internet, there are these routers in the middle, the gateway routers, right? That route your packets. If you want to go to certain IP address, because that's how we route. We route with the IP address. And what we look is we look at the mask. There's something called the subnet mask. And we apply the mask to the IP address, and we see if it's in our SIP network or not. If it's in our network, we are responsible with it. We can route the packets to that device. If it's not in our subnetwork, right, then we will basically route it to the gateway. And that's how we basically move on with packets. So I'll give you an example of this, right? So if I have my IP address is 192.168.1.3, right, and my other device is 192.168.1.4, okay, these are the same network, right? Same gateway. My router gave these IP addresses to these two networks. So if I want to send an information, a packet, to this machine, which is, let's say, a Node.js server, I'm listening on my laptop and I want to connect from my phone. So if I use 192.168.1.4, I can communicate. How does that work? At first, my phone asked the question, 192.168.1.4, is it in my subnetwork? It's very simple. And it applies this, something called the subnet mask, which is 255.255.255.0. Or sometimes it's 255.000. It really applies, it depends on your subnet mask. And just applies it. And if it ends up with the same number, which is 192.168.1, oh, we are on the same network. So let me just send you the information directly. I'm not going to even go through a router. it does go through the router because the router acts like a switch in this case, and we just forward the packet immediately. It doesn't need to go to the internet and goes back. It's internal. So what we learn here is we learn that my packet goes through a lot of devices on the internet until it reaches the final destination. And these devices, the problem with these devices and why we need another reason we need encryption is these devices actually checks the protocol. So it's okay, wait a second. Is this TCP? Okay, send packet looks like this. Is this HTTP? HTTP port 80? Okay. HTTP should look like /, and a new line and whatever. And if you send me something else, some routers, not all of them, actually validate those packets. How can they validate? Because it's unencrypted. They can look at the content. And when they validate that content, they validate that GET request, they can potentially drop the packet. So what does that mean? Hussein, that's okay. If someone is not following the protocol, sure. Let's just do it. Let's just let them drop these packets. That's not actually as simple as it sounds. Because this puts a huge problem in our shoulder for how we're going to upgrade the protocol in the future. If we're going to upgrade the protocol, then the new protocol is not going to follow the old protocol semantics. It's going to have new stuff. And guess what? If the old routers sees the new stuff, it's going to say, that's bad, drop it. That's how it happened with HTTP 2. When people first implemented HTTP 2, they changed the whole, it's a whole completely different platform. It's not no longer text-based. Well, it is text-based, but it's binary and has the idea of streams. And when you have streams, these packets are completely different. It has different header, it has different, the data have different headers, the actual headers have different headers from layer 4 perspective. So the whole thing is different. So what happened from browsers when they started implementing HTTP 2, they start just dropping these HTTP 2 packets. You might be lucky and hit a router that doesn't validate, but if you hit a router that does validate and only supports HTTP 1.1, then you're out of luck. So that's what happened. So HTTP 2 unencrypted is no longer supported. H2C, that's what it's called. H2C no longer supported because of this. Well, that's one reason at least. So people need to encrypt. If you encrypt stuff, then the routers will say, wait, look, to me, this is just a TCP packet. There is a destination IP address. There is a source IP address. There is a source port. There is a destination IP address. There is a destination port. I'm not going to look at the content because I don't know what this is. Clearly, it's encrypted. So they will just forward along. They will not do deep packet inspection. That's what it's called, deep packet inspection. So two reasons that we need encryption. This, the first reason, well, I don't want my ISP to see what I'm searching for on Google. The second thing is routers in the middle of the internet the word is ossified. Let me write it down. Ossified. Hopefully I spell it right. Ossified. I don't know what that word means because I'm not a native English speaker, but it means essentially it's solidify. That protocol is just solidify. That's called protocol ossification. And we talked about it. It becomes ossified. And the routers are ossified. You might say, Hussein, that's just dumb. Just upgrade all those routers to support HTTP 2. That doesn't work like that. Those routers should remain untouched because they spend years and years and years to perfect them. And if you install some new patch, how the hell are you going to test this? It's untestable. It's very hard. You can bring the whole internet down. It's very risky to apply patches, right? Ossified, turn to bone. That's what it means. Ossified, to turn to a bone. That's what I think the medical explanation. So protocol ossification plus the need of having privacy. Meet TLS. before we jump into TLS, essentially, before we jump into TLS, we need to understand that there is something called encryption. What is encryption, really? There are two types. Symmetric encryption and asymmetric encryption. And we need to understand why we need both. Why? Because in this channel, guys, we ask the why. We don't just take things for granted. We challenge and call the BS out. If something doesn't make sense, ask a question. Ask why does it exist? Why is it this? Why is it this way? Why do we need this? You'll find that there's always an answer. And if there is not an answer, that means this technology or whatever you're asking is there's something that is missed. Something that's been missed. That's the idea. Ben, hi, first stream I am on and I'm going back for my mom's birthday party. Thanks for the good vids. Happy birthdays, Ben, for your mom. Enjoy. Enjoy your vacation. And enjoy the stream and the videos. Glad you like them. Reverse proxy also acts as a load balancer and does SSL offloading. Oh yeah, we'll come to that. Reverse proxies. Yeah, that's another thing that kind of acts like something that is in the middle. The one I was explaining before is just the native routers that we don't explicitly, it's called almost like they call transparent proxies, which is almost like act like a routers, and the packets pass through them, but you don't have a choice to what packet you route to them. Reverse proxy, you actually have a choice. You're targeting the reverse proxy. When you go to google.com, most probably the final destination is your reverse proxy. That's your IP address of the reverse proxy. So the reverse proxy is the final destination to you, and that means it terminates everything. It needs sometimes, not always, it needs to decrypt the traffic and look at what you're doing and then re-forward the traffic on the back end. We talked about that many times, but I don't think we have time to cover it in this channel. But we'll discuss. Still waiting for the caching episode. Thanks, Ali. We'll definitely do the caching episode soon. We're doing caching. We're going to talk about caching. It's a different beast. We made one video on caching, and it's called Varnish. Just Google Varnish Hussein. And that's a technology. It's shaped like a rabbit. And that's a caching server. So we talked about that. Hussein, do you have a Discord server? Yes, I do. I don't have the link because I don't know how to make the Discord server fancy link, because I don't know stuff. So check out my description. It's or go to HusseinNasser.com. It's somewhere there. I have it. The community there is amazing. We discuss a lot of good backend engineering. A lot of you guys in there in Discord give me news that I need to cover, interesting news. So I love it. What's the difference between SSL and TLS? It's SSL is the old name, TLS is the new name. SSL stands for Secure Socket Layer, which is not used anymore. And TLS is the new protocol, which stands for Transport Layer Security. We'll come to that. Thanks, Jane. My HSTS question, VJ. Did you ask a question? I didn't see it. HSTS. HSTS is actually interesting. Yes. Correct. SSL is the old thing, Kalyan. All right, so encryption. Meet encryption. How do we encrypt stuff, guys? If you have a safe in your home and you put some content in the safe, how do you lock it? You take a key or you have a PIN code and you literally lock it, right? That's the same thing in the hotels. When you go to a hotel, there is a PIN code that you just create a new PIN code, and that's your key. And then how to open it? Use the same exact key to open the safe, right? That's called symmetric encryption. You use the key, a key to encrypt and a key to decrypt. And this is a whole different beast, just talking about symmetric encryption and the keys and the algorithm. There are so many algorithms, and there are so many weak algorithms. Sorry. Weak algorithm. And there are so many strong algorithms. AES is the dominant now, and there's the bit key. How big is the key that you use in order to encrypt? It's all different beasts. However, there is one limitation in symmetric encryption. Symmetric encryption is great if you like encrypt your own files on your Mac right here. It's or something in the same device, right? I'm going to encrypt it here. So I'm going to generate the key. I'm the only one who knows the key. I'm going to encrypt it and keep it in my device. So if someone else wants to grab my device, they cannot decrypt it because they don't have the key, because I know the key. Right? So that's perfect. However, think about it a little bit. Let's go back to transport layer security. Transport. It's transporting. You're going to transport some packets from one place to another place. Can you use symmetric encryption for this? Well, think about it. How do you guys agree on the key? Because the act of saying that, hey, I'm going to encrypt something, I'm going to send it to you, that other person must have the same key in order to decrypt it. Right? That's symmetric encryption. But it comes back to the same exact problem we talked about when the stream starts. How do you send the key that you just made up, right? You created a key and you encrypted the content and you send the encrypted content, but the other party will not be able to decrypt it because it doesn't have the key. So Hussein, just send the key. All right, let's send the key, but the key is not really encrypted, is it? Right? It's not encrypted. Well, just use another encryption algorithm, generate another key and encrypt the key and send it over. But what about the other key? How do you send that other key to encrypt the key that encrypts the original encryption? All just in, you don't do that, right? That's just nuts. So symmetric encryption is great, but that's the limitation of it. Transporting. The idea here, how can I transport the key from one place to another place without anyone in the middle sniffing? Because we know there are a lot of people in the middle sniffing. There are transparent proxies. There are routers. There are the ISPs, right? Everybody in the middle that goes... We don't control what goes in the middle, but they essentially have access to whatever you send. So how can I transfer the packet or the key in a secure way? Meet asymmetric encryption. So asymmetric encryption came into the picture and says, okay, some people said, you guys are smart. You came up with this symmetric encryption, which is awesome. But we really need a way to encrypt with a key and decrypt with a completely different key. Can you guys do this? And RSA, the people of RSA, which I keep forgetting their names, RSA Wiki, came up with a solution. It's time for Ravest Shamir Adelman. Three people, I believe. Three people. Came up and said, okay, we're going to give you an encryption algorithm. It's called asymmetric. Asymmetric means it's not symmetric. It's not the same thing. So the idea here is you have a private key and a public key. You encrypt with the private key and you decrypt with the public key, or vice versa. Sometimes it applies vice versa. You encrypt with the public key and you only can decrypt with the private key. It's always like that. So this is perfect. So now, if I can take the private key, if I only have the private key, I can safely distribute the public key to anyone and then use the public key to encrypt and the private key to decrypt. Let's try that out. So let's go back to the same situation. Client and server, I want to send an information, but prior, I somehow need to obtain the server's public key. Let's say we got it. and it's safely transported and encrypted. Let the ISPs get the public key. It's already public. Who cares? Let the transparent proxies get it. Let everybody get it. Let shady people get it. I don't care. Because once I get the public key, I'm going to now, as a client, generate my symmetric key, encrypt it with the public key. It's not as simple, but I'm simplifying it. And then sending that encrypted information that has the key in it. That's the symmetric, the first key. Now I send it over. And then people in the middle says, okay, what is this? Nobody can get it. People have the public key. They cannot decrypt it. They can't possibly decrypt that public key. Why? Because the public key only encrypts. It doesn't encrypt, or vice versa. So now the server will receive that information. The server will look at the packet. Okay, server only has the private key. And then takes that packet and then decrypts it. And looks, oh, I have now the symmetric key. Now we can safely, we transported the key, the symmetric key that we need. So both parties know the key. And this is called the handshake, right? This is basically called a key exchange. Sorry, not the handshake. So we just exchanged the key. So Yogesh, he's right. No concept of key. It's actually the algorithm is a secret, right? So the it's more complicated than that. I'm just simplifying it. So there is a secret that generates the key. It's kind of the same thing if you think about it, just for the illustration purposes. But yeah, the secret is what is encrypted. And you, the other party need to know which algorithm, which encryption algorithm you use, like AES, Blowfish, Cha-Cha, whatever, right? So now we managed to communicate that. Is this encryption algorithm perfect? There are some problems with this, and I talked about it many times on my channel. The problem that happened with here, so it's like, okay, now we have two parties, and we didn't talk about TLS yet. I'm just telling you the concept behind encryption, and then we'll jump to TLS, hopefully. So the concept here is, it's there. I have two parties that managed to establish communication between them. How did we do that? We obtained the public key of the server, and the server has the private key matching it. We took the public key. We created a symmetric secret key using our own symmetric key encryption that we talked about. We encrypted that piece of information using the server's public key. And then we started encrypting the content as well. And then we sent all this garbage out, right? And nobody in the middle can understand it. Double quote, because we're going to get to that. Some people did actually manage to get that. And then servers get it. The server have the matching private key. It opens the content up and understand everything. And nobody else can, because only the server has the private key. And that's the problem. Do you think if the server have some long-running private key? Remember, this is a private key that you generate once, a public key, and that's it. It sits there for years and years and years. Wow. What happened? Imagine everything, every single communication is done because of that private key. You can technically be in the middle as an ISP and start recording all these encrypted encryptions. Everything is encrypted. Just save it in disk. Save it. So you have history of months of encryption chats, communication between you. But say, okay, I'll wait. Then all of a sudden, something called Heartbleed happened. Heartbleed, guys, if you don't know about it, Google it. Just go to heartbleed.io, I believe, or .com. Heartbleed was a bug that allows a client to ask a server to obtain certain amount of memory, of its private memory address. And guess what stays in memory most of the time? Most important information that is frequently used. What is frequently used on the server? The private freaking key. So people use this OpenSSL bug, which is the most famous security library that provides these encryption algorithms that we talked about, right? And they used an extension called Heartbleed, Heartbeat, I believe it's called. So it's just like, hey, are you alive? Are you alive? Are you alive? And that, there's a concept that you can change the number of bytes that you request. It's like, okay, give me 1,000 bytes. And when you ask for that, you will get, there was a buffer problem where they weren't validating the check, and we're giving, you're getting your data that you actually asked for, but you're getting anything after that. And if you know how programming works and how stuff in the memory, if you are lucky and you got stuff in the memory, you just leaked it out. It bled. It's called heart bleed problem. So private keys were leaked. The moment you get the private key, the ISP have it now. All of it needs to do is just go through all the past encryption. Oh, here's how when they send the key. It's encrypted with a private key. I have the private key now. Beautiful. Terrific. We just got the key. Now, once you have the key, the symmetric key, right? You just now have the algorithm. You know how this communication is encrypted. Just decrypt everything. And now you have the plain text of everything. That's called the problem. This is the problem is called forward secrecy. The idea of forward for secrecy or perfect forward secrecy is that once something is leaked, you can encrypt or decrypt past communication. And this was solved with Diffie-Hellman and elliptic curve Diffie-Hellman, which I'm not going to get into, but maybe in just a minute. But yeah, so the idea here is don't have something that is only known to one party. Let the two party negotiate the key. Half the key and half the key, and then you merge it and you have full knowledge. That's what Diffie-Hellman did. They changed from RSA, which is a private public key, to a completely different model where they actually have, they build the key or the secret using pieces only known to them. And I talked about that a little bit in my Diffie-Hellman video. Check it out, right? So essentially, it involves some mathematics, right? You generate a number, you raise it to a power, and then you send that public number, you mod it with another public number. And then using just pure math, the idea of having x to the power of z y, right, is equal to x to the power z times x to the power y. And that's a plus. Yes, yeah, essentially you add them. Right? That's the idea. No, it's x to the power z to the power of y equal x to the power z times y, right? So that's the idea. Using just simple math and power equation, they actually essentially did that. I'm not going to go into the details, but the idea here is only the client knows part of the key, the server knows part of the key, and they exchange public information. And if you're in the middle, you cannot derive that. Even that has been broken if the key length has been short with Diffie-Hellman. This has been solved with elliptic curve Diffie-Hellman, but the idea is this. We now can exchange algorithms. And now, guys, we end up with so many algorithms. Asymmetric algorithm this, symmetric algorithm that. So we talked about so many variation. How do we build a protocol, meet TLS? After 1 hour, I start explaining TLS. This is how complicated this thing is. And there might be people obviously more skilled in teaching than I am, guys, to that kind of deliver the message in a fewer words. But I like to explain everything. That's just me. Right. F5 videos on cryptography are really good. I agree. I love those videos. They are really good. My only problem with that is just they assume you know some basic stuff. Which to a network engineer, they make perfect sense. To a software engineer, they kind of sometimes are ambiguous to me at least. I don't know about other people, but I agree, they are great. So yeah, guys, that's TLS now is the protocol that manages everything that I talked about. How about we jump into the TLS 1.2? The first, I'm not going to talk about 1.0 and 1.1. I'm going to talk about TLS 1.2 and then TLS 1.3. And then we maybe end the screen. Stream. Let's take some chat messages and discuss a little bit. Take some break. Is the password which we use while installing the certificate in MMC, the server, is the private key. So, certificates here is another thing that we didn't talk about. I think we need to talk about certificates before jumping into TLS. Thank you for the question. Taking some sip of water. So certificates, why do we need certificates? Same question, why? So the main purpose of certificate is to actually know whom I am talking to. Am I actually talking to the server or am I actually talking to someone else? Because you cannot guarantee that. Let's think about that. If I send a packet request to google.com, someone in the middle can decide to reply back with a send, right? Instead of actually forwarding the packet. Okay? That could be easily done if you have low-level control over the packets. So they can reply, and they initiate the TCP connection, and they can communicate on behalf of Google. Because they can reply to your stuff instead of just forwarding it. That's what the router does. So the router decide to reply to you with a SYN. You don't know that you got the reply from the router versus Google because the router, if it's shady, can put the source IP address as Google. Who knows? Who cares? It comes from Google. You can fake all that stuff. You can spoof all that stuff if you have low-level control. So you can establish a TCP connection, but you don't know whom you're talking to. You cannot guarantee. So TLS came into the picture and says, I need something that proves that the destination that just served this is actually the one I'm talking to. And that's where certificate came into the picture. And certificate need to be not linked to the IP address, need to be linked to a domain most of the time, like google.com or yahoo.com. And what they do essentially is they are signed by some other particle certificate authorities. And we talked about that a little bit. Check out the certificate authority video that I made if you want details. But the certificate authority is another party that has a private and a public key. It takes its private key and encrypts the server's public key to prove that, hey, I vote for this guy or gal. This server is good. I trust that it's actually Google. We verified that they own the domain. We verified that we placed some text file and we communicate and they actually know it. So we're good. So they generate this certificate and signed. And when I say signed, it's reversed. Now the private key actually encrypts and the public key actually verifies or decrypts. So it's with the signature is reversed, right? With the encryption, it's public key encrypts, private key decrypts. With the signature, private key encrypts, public key verifies. So now you have a certificate that says google.com. Anyone can build that. That's not enough. You need it signed by someone you can trust, which is a certificate authority. And the same thing that can for the certificate authority. How can I trust the certificate authority? You need to be signed by either another certificate authority or another something called root certificate authority that you just blindly trust. This is a beautiful root certificate that is from China. You just trust it. This is a root from Russia. You just trust it. This is a root certificate from USA. You just trust it. And mainly these roots are installed, pre-installed on your machines, on your phone. Now you can go into conspiracy theory and wear your tinfoil hat and say, oh, do you really trust these root certificates? Maybe no, maybe yes. I'm not going there. But yeah, so there is a chain. It's called chain of trust. So once you receive the certificate authority certificate, you say you're Google. Let me verify. Who is your parent? Who are your chain? Who is your parent chain? It's all there. It's called certificate full chain. Sometimes if you create a reverse proxy in Nginx, it says full chain dot, what's the extension? PEM. It says full chain, actual full chain. So that's full chain up until the root. So, and this is a lot really more complicated because sometimes the verification can go into multiple parents and it's a mess. Some libraries get verification wrong because they don't branch. They think it's always one parent. They assume one root parent. And as a result, if this expired, then you assume the certificate is invalid, although there is another branch with a trusted root, right? So that's what happened, I think, in May this year, 2020, I believe. All of a sudden, one trusted root certificate expired, and all of the algorithms that verify the certificates were basically implemented wrong. Ryan Sleevey, I believe, from Twitter, he's an expert in SSL. I suggest you guys follow him. Ryan Sleevey, I believe his name. He's expert in certificates and all that stuff. I follow him for all the stuff that I don't understand. So he actually explained how it works. Oh man, this is complex stuff. So get back to that question. How do I know this is Google? Who signed you? Let's Encrypt signed you. That's not true, but let's just take an example. Oh, Let's Encrypt. Who's Let's Encrypt? Do I trust Let's Encrypt? Well, who signed Let's Encrypt? I don't know. Trusted Union CCC, right? Okay, let's take their public key, verifies the certificate authority. Good. That matches. Take the public key of the Let's Encrypt, verifies the Google's one. They claim the Google. Check. So now you have a trust. That's the certificate of trust. That's just certificate. It's just so complicated topic. Now, let's come back to the shady scenario where someone can fake a certificate. Can you fake a certificate? Absolutely. I can, this second, go to OpenSSL-create X05, that's the format of the certificate, and say, create a self-signed certificate claiming to be Google.com. You can absolutely do this. But nobody's going to trust you. Why? Because it's self-signed. And you are shady. You are shady. Nobody trusts you. You're self-signed. You're signing your self-certificate. Who trusts you? Who are you? The only certificate that is self-signed and we trust is the root certificate. That's the God certificate. We trust it because it's installed in my computer that says as a trusted device. That was the original question, and we answered it almost, I think we answered it well. So yeah, this is how we do it. That's how we essentially verify the certificate. So now, if someone in the middle, if I'm going to google.com, and someone in the middle decided to create a certificate, self-sign, and served me that, my client will start verifying. He says, wait a second. Yes, that certificate claims to be Google, but it's self-signed. That is not the one that is not trusted by anyone. I'm not going to trust it. Fail the connection, terminate the connection. So that's how one way to do it. Some people are more smarter than that. Some people generate a chain with a certificate authorities. If you get to have a trusted certificate authority to sign your certificate claiming to be google.com, then you can do it. But guess what? No certificate authority will do that. Let's Encrypt is not going to do that. DigiSign not going to do that. If you found some certificate that actually does that, and it did exist back in the, I think, early 2000s, it was a Dutch certificate authority and was signing certificate left and right for shady people, claiming to be someone else. And now, your certificate will be trusted, but guess what? The moment we find out that it's actually a shady certificate, this certificate authority will be killed, revoked. It's called revoked. And this certificates, man, certificates are a completely different world. People take careers just focusing on security with certificate. That's Ryan Sleevey, right? That's his job. This is a certificate. And he just tells you, oh, it's all word by itself. People goes to him for certificates, right? So yeah, verification, revocation, and talking about revocation, how do you revoke a certificate of authority that's all of a sudden it's not valid? But how do you tell other people that, hey, by the way, hey guys, this certificate of authority is not valid anymore? How do you do that? You need a centralized server that verifies, that has a database of shady certs. And that's what's called, I think, OCSP, Online Certificate Status Protocol. OCSP is a protocol by itself that validates whether a certificate is shady or not. It's a completely different thing. So that's certificate in general. So we talked about encryption, we talked about certificates, so we can know that the other party is what I'm talking about. Hussein, why do we have certificate only one side? Why is the server only the one serving us certificates? Why don't the client serve a certificate to the server? That's called mutual TLS, MTLS, where you have both parties actually trusting each other. In a browser, Google doesn't care to verify you. Otherwise, imagine, like, if Google need to verify every single machine in the whole world, nobody can access Google, right? So that's why Google is one way. Most web browsing is always one way validation, because we don't really need to check that, hey, do you trust you? However, in microservices architecture, this is very, very, very critical. Mutual TLS. I need that to know service A, service B can only talk to service B, and service B need to trust that service A is the one talking. Otherwise, someone in the cloud in the middle, if they manage to do that, they can fake it. And they can create a certificate that claim to be service A and talk on their behalf. That's why you have your own certificate authority in the cloud, microservice architecture. That's where Kubernetes comes really handy if you think about it. If you're going that level of scale. But yeah, Dipan, thank you. Thank you for watching and thank you for your comments, everybody. Appreciate it. So we talked about all that stuff. Let's take some break. Get some question in, get some more chatting in before we jump and end the stream. We still need to talk about TLS 1.2 because we didn't discuss it. It's going to be short. Ooh. It would be great if you can explain with a whiteboard. I agree. I don't know. I really want to make this as a just casual chat and that fits the podcast. I understand with a whiteboard, but I have videos, man. Dipan, I have videos doing whiteboard with TLS. So check out my content, right? So this is not supposed to be something that it's just like a class, right? It's just we casually chat about things, and it means morely to be like something you listen in the background and you interact and answer your questions, something like that, right? Lots of embedded hardware has very little computing power. Yeah, that's true. Encryption. So encryption is complex to, let's say, IoT hardware. So that's a good point. Encryption in devices with low power. We mentioned asymmetric encryption, guys, and symmetric encryption. Asymmetric encryption is way more complicated. Especially Diffie-Hellman, when you go, not much elliptic curve Diffie-Hellman compared to Diffie-Hellman itself. Elliptic curve Diffie-Hellman, now you can work with a fewer bit size. Just the whole trick is how much bits are you working with? If you're working with 1,024 bits versus 2,048 bits, like an RSA, some RSA algorithm had 96 bits. That's a lot of bits. That's a lot of bits. So computing the algorithms and raising to the powers and all this complex mathematical equation becomes really slow. So we need power. Symmetric algorithm, on the other hand, they are cheaper. Mostly because they are small in size. Bit size, I think 256, maximum 300 something. So the smaller the bit size, the key you work with, the faster the algorithm. But yeah. Essentially, it depends on the algorithm. So that's why when you design, you deploy your Nginx, your reverse proxy, your HA proxy, your Envoy, you take into consideration what ciphers you use. And that's all where a smart DevOps engineer or a software engineer can come and says, okay, my main consumer of this particular encryption, the server is an IoT device. An IoT device, I need to use a cipher that is secure. Yeah, it's secure, but it's not really expensive to compute, right? So you don't choose Diffie-Hellman 4098, right? Or I say 4000, it's not secure anyway, right? You choose something like elliptic curve Diffie-Hellman with 256 bits, right? And you, even 300, 256, you might say, oh, I'm going to always pick 320 bits, whatever. No, really. The difference between them is really, it's going to take, I don't know, 200 years to break versus 300 years to break. Or 500 years to break. Really? If someone is really interested in your shady IoT logging device, then maybe in 200 years they can have the data where everybody's already dead. And when the robots already took over the world. Ahmed Khadir. Hello. Hi. Omar Farouk. If I delete a certificate from Trusted Root in MMC, which is the, what's that, Microsoft Management Console, I think that's what it stands for, it automatically come back in 5 seconds. I don't know the reason. Ooh, that's a good reason. So what Omar did here is he deleted a trusted certificate. He says, hey, I don't really trust this certificate that says, let's check YouTube. What is the certificate? Root certificate here. It's Global Sign. So that's an example of Global Sign. So what you can do, guys, is literally just go to your Chrome, wherever you're watching this, click on the lock, and you can see the root, the chain. You can see the chain for any site you go to. Right? So if Global Sign, so Omar wanted to delete the Global Sign, says, hey, I don't trust Global Sign. Microsoft or whatever the Windows operating system he's using says, no, really, you cannot delete that, sir. Sit down. You cannot delete Global Sign. Because if you delete Global Sign, you cannot communicate to anything else. Even Microsoft themselves, their APIs, need to communicate with the outside Microsoft servers. Maybe they are using Global Sign as their trusted root. So if you do that, you can actually not just block normal browsing. You can actually, your Windows will stop working. I don't know, Windows update will stop working, something like that. So I didn't get the notification today. Oh, sorry, Nexon. I usually stream Saturdays, 9 a.m. Usually, right? I'll try to schedule it. Sorry, I didn't schedule it this year. this week. I'll make sure to schedule it this week. I don't know how to schedule and do all this stuff. I'm such a boomer when it comes to this stuff. So yeah, if you delete a certificate, that's what most Chinese laptop, if you get a Chinese laptop from China, they actually install their own root certificate with the laptop. So that if you decided to go to Google and the Chinese government happened to intercept your traffic somehow, it's not easy, but if you're in China, it's easy, right? Because you have to go through ISP, and ISP owned by the government in China, so they can immediately. If you're in America, I really doubt that you're going their path. So you're not going through them. So they, remember, man in the middle only happen if you actually, your packet actually goes through that man or woman, right? To actually intercept it. So some Chinese laptops comes with these trusted devices. And if you have a trusted certificate, root, the ISP can say, oh, I'm going to Google, right? So the packet, I say I am in China, right? And I have a laptop with a trusted Chinese certificate. That's what happened to Kazakhstan government. So exactly the same thing, right? You install the device. And once you install it, that trusted certificate, you want to go to Google to search something. You establish a TCP connection. That's fine, right? That can be intercepted because the ISP will just respond with a SYN. And then turn around and send back another packet to Google, right? And establish a connection. It's like almost like a reverse proxy place. And then the ISP will say, hey, you want to go to Google? Here is a certificate signed by Google. It's actually signed by the shady trusted certificate. Let's call it, I don't know, the Great Firewall of China, Trusted LLC. Okay, so, and says, oh, this is google.com. Your browser, your machine will say, okay, we just got a certificate that says it's a Google.com. Who's the certificate authority? Some certificate authority that we don't know about in China. Okay, who trust? Can I trust this? Yeah, who's the root? The root is Great Firewall of China, and it's trusted by the certificate. Is this trusted on my machine? Yup, that's good. It's trusted. Your machine trusts this. All right, I guess I'm talking to Google, I guess. But you're not. You are not talking to Google. You're talking to the ISP in this case, right? And then you start establish. Once you trust it, you start establishing the TLS session, client hello, all that stuff. You can negotiate the keys. And guess what? You're negotiating the keys between you and not Google. You're negotiating between you and the ISP because you trusted it. And then you start encrypting the communication between you and the ISP. And that's fine because they have the key because you just negotiated with them. And then you can send, hey, I want to look how to get a girlfriend in 10 days. Enter. Right? And then the government, the ISP will say, oh, let's decrypt the content. Oh, how do you get... This guy is desperate. Okay. And then we log information that, oh, Hussein just looking for a girlfriend. And then they turn around and send the actual request to Google and then get back the content from Google. That's a pure man-in-the-middle attack. And then just get back the result and then respond back with the content. And you don't even know, right? There is no way to know this stuff unless you actually are adept in this stuff and you can look at the certificate and says, okay, I don't really know if this certificate is trusted or not. And I mean, do you know all the trusted certificates? I don't know them, to be honest. Shah Sheikh Nasser, I love your content. Thank you so much. Hi, Nasser. How are you doing? Prangal, thank you. I'm doing great. Thank you so much. How to defend against layer 7 proxy DDoS where traffic is actually legit? Oh yeah. Layer 7 proxying denial of server. So proxies, when they are layer 7, they can actually essentially act like exactly what we talked about. They serve you the certificate because they have it, right? So they look at the content. And then most of the time, layer 7 proxy, reverse proxy like Cloudflare, if you deploy that service, they can protect you against denial of service attack because they can know if a request is legit or not because they are encrypting, you're decrypting your traffic. Sometimes you say, I'm not comfortable with them decrypting my traffic. Says, okay, you only get layer 4 proxying, which is just a blind look at the IP and the port. That's the only thing they look at. So yeah. So a layer 7 proxy gives you more a little bit DDoS protection, the denial of service, because you need to know the source IP address. You need to know more information about the nature of the request. If the request is going to a certain location a long time from certain IP addresses, you get a full picture. And as a result, you can understand more and you can block more DDoS attack, sophisticated DDoS attack. Ooh, lots of chats this time. Where are all the root certificate as well as CA servers in my Mac? I don't know, to be honest. We need to search that. I don't know where it's stored, but it's stored in the Mac somewhere. We'll Google that some other time. I was like, where is it stored? How do we know Mac addresses as we are exposed to internet using public IP address? Yeah, you don't. Mac addresses, dealing with Mac addresses is just something internal. You don't deal with the Mac addresses on the public web. You deal with Mac addresses when you're sending devices in a local intranet. Like if I send an information between my phone to my laptop, I'm going to use the Mac address because I'm literally going to do an ARP request and say, okay, who has this IP address? And it's going to say, and only I'm going to do this because I know it's in the same subnet. If it's not in the same subnet, I send it to the gateway all the time. That's how the whole internet works. And then, yeah, you don't care about the MAC address because MAC address is just an internal thing. Once you go to the public web, nobody cares about your MAC address. Hope WebRTC videos will come. Lots of questions on my side. Oh, yeah, they will come. The WebRTC video. It's going to be a long video. I talked about it when I started the stream. It's a very interesting video. I'm still working on it. I like your style of teaching. I learned IndexedDB from your channel. I can't wait to learn WebRTC. Thanks, Eric. I appreciate that. I'm glad you enjoyed the IndexedDB. IndexedDB is one of the databases that just, it's like, okay, what is this thing? I need to understand it. And I dive deep into it and learned more about it and made a video. And a lot of people like that video. Although I shot it with a very bad audio, I think. It wasn't great. And I rambled a lot. I used to ramble a lot. I mean, I still ramble a lot. That's why I have this live stream to get it off my chest. What is the best book to learn TLS and SSL? I don't recommend a book. I don't have a book, to be honest, but everything is in Wikipedia. And in the Wikipedia or RFC, I always read the RFC if I want to know deep into stuff, right? What happens if someone spoof a legitimate certificate? Will it be blocked by the browser? We talked about that, right? If you spoofed a legitimate certificate, the browser still need to verify that certificate. And it does that by going up the chain. So, okay, you just created, how did you spoof the legitimate certificate? You cannot just spoof it, right? Because you have to generate a new certificate and says, okay, I claim to be yahoo.com. Okay, who vouch for you that you're Yahoo? Oh, this certificate authority. Who vouch for this certificate authority? Or this certificate authority? Who vouch for this? Root. And if the root is trusted, you're good. If any of the chain is not trusted, the connection is blocked. That's why something I forgot to mention. A lot of people, when they code and they get this error, oh, unable to verify the certificate, they do this --- insecure in curl. make a request, get request and say, okay, let's just don't verify the certificate. There is options in the client to not verify the certificate. That is bad, guys. Do not do this. Do it when you're internally testing, but don't push that to production. That's just bad. That is a bad idea. You do not do that, right? Especially if you communicate with public things. There is one reason where you want to do, you disable verification of the certificate by, if you're doing TLS pinning or SSL pinning. So SSL pinning, let me write it down for you if you want to search. SSL pinning, is it double pin or TLS pinning? So TLS on TLS or SSL pinning, it's something we talked about in the channel as well, is the idea of having, you know what? I don't trust anyone in the public internet. I don't trust Google. I don't trust anybody. I don't trust the US. I don't trust China. I don't trust anybody. I only trust my server. I want to make sure that it's actually my server. And because this trusted thing and the idea of the trusted stuff is what? If you do the trusted certificates, you're relying on someone else to do the trust for you. So if you trust them, if you trust Microsoft who installed the trusted certificate on your machine, you're fine. But if you don't, if you trust Apple, you're fine. But if you don't trust Apple or Microsoft or China, you do TLS pinning. And especially in your application, if you're connected only to one server, what do? You generate a stinking self-signed certificate for your server. You don't have to go to any certificate authority. And you put it there. It's a self-signed. And you take a hash of that self-signed certificate, and you actually burn it in the code, in your code, and says, if I'm going to communicate with a server, please, only if I got this exact certificate hashed, allow the connection. So the connection is not secure because this is untrusted, right? But your client will just disable verification, that normal verification, and it will do its own verification in the code, hard coded. So your code will always make sure to only connect to that server. That is powerful. TLS pinning in mobile application, very, very powerful. A lot of people use it, right? But again, it's a little bit sophisticated to maintain. If you expire the certificate, what do? You have to update the code, stuff like that. WebRTC is good, or any alternative, please. Yeah, WebRTC is great. Again, WebRTC is just peer-to-peer, right? So to me, I'll just use WebSockets. But sometimes if you communicate between two parties, just two parties, WebRTC is the best because it's literally peer-to-peer. And the fastest path between two machines is the direct path, not any other server. I mean, WebRTC can fall back to a turn server, which kind of just traverse and relay your packets. And that the idea is, I don't see it any different than just having a web server that you relay your packets from. So yeah, guys. So that's TLS, security, all that stuff. What are your opinion on storing JWT secret in environment variable inside my Docker Compose YAML? If it's an environment variable and you somehow pass it to the application, so the application is not aware of that secret, so I guess that's fine. But the question is, where do you store? That's what I... It's very hard to deal with these kind of secrets when it comes to JWT, because you deal with JWT, you have to have a separate key management, because you now you have problem with the key, and what if the key is expired? You have to invalidate the key. So you have the exact same problem we have with certificates, right? I prefer session management all day long when it comes to simple authentication, let's say. But I might be wrong again. Which port is the fastest? My friend says 3,000, but says my teacher says 1,000. There's no port as fast as I think you're trolling, right? That's a troll. That's a troll question. The ports are, there are no ports that are fastest than the other. I mean, ports that are less than 1,000 are system ports. They are given higher priority by the system. So I don't know if they are faster, to be honest. They might be given special permission, to be honest, from the operating system. Special behavior and special treatment. Does that make them faster? I cannot say for sure. But they are system maintained. Anything below 1,000. If you can listen to a port less than 1,000, maybe. So yeah, I don't know. That's actually a good question now. I thought it's a troll, but maybe it's legit. All right, final thing before we end this stream. I'm getting hungry. I need to go have some breakfast and wish you guys goodbye, and you're enjoying your rest of the weekend. All right, so TLS, guys, we're going to talk about TLS 1.2 before we jump. So TLS 1.2, guys, if I want to communicate between two parties, the first thing that the server says, the client says, I need TCP. So SYN, SYNACK, and ACK. Once you have this TCP connection, the first thing you do is TLS hello. And you say, hey, I support this symmetric encryption algorithm. I support this asymmetric encryption algorithm. So we can negotiate everything. And I have these extensions. I also support HTTP2 by default, by the way, if you want to communicate HTTP2. I also support OCSP stapling, and I have these protocols to support. I have H1 and H2 and other stuff. So that's, and by the way, here's, let's start encryption. So that's what TLS 1.2 says. It doesn't do anything. It just say hello. The server says, all right, this is what the client supports. He supports this and this and this and this. The server get to choose. So, okay, based on my encryption and then my knowledge, I think these encryption algorithms are the best. So we're going to go with those encryption algorithms because they are the best. So that's the server being, yeah, so the server start being now deciding what server, what things to pick. And then it says, okay, let's pick this. And let's pick this symmetric algorithm. And let's pick this cipher and this cipher. So it picks something called the cipher suite. And the cipher suite is a collection of ciphers from asymmetric encryption, which is the key exchange, which is Diffie-Hellman, elliptic curve Diffie-Hellman, whether it's RSA, just some asymmetric thing. And then also send, hey, this is my certificate as well. So that's, if you want to trust me, look at the certificate to trust me or not. And then, whoop, we get back the server sent hello. Now the client says, okay, we got this. Now the client says, okay, all right, we now have the symmetric encryption. We know what algorithm to use. Let's start communication. So we'll start building the keys, the key encryption algorithm. We'll say, okay, let's exchange the key, right? So we'll start building the key and then sending that information back. And the server will say, okay, let me build my part of the encryption algorithm and then generate the key. And then once both of them have the information, they will start encryption. The server will say, okay, I'm done. So four requests at minimum to complete a full encryption. That's TLS 1.2, by the way. Right? And TLS 1.2 allows for RSA, allows for not perfectly forward encryption, allows for all that stuff. So they start communicating and they start encryption, all that stuff, right? So that now once you get the actual key, both of them have the symmetric key, they can actually talk to each other. So the client will encrypt the content and they will start sending their first GET request. And that's it. That's how TLS 1.2 work. In TLS 1.3, and I'm going to summarize it quickly, this is obviously slow, right? Because now you have two round trips to negotiate. So in TLS 1.3, they said, you know what, let's just not negotiate as much. Client, make a guess. Make a guess on what server, what cipher we're going to pick. Make a guess on which symmetric algorithm we're going to pick. And just start building your encryption part before you send it to me. So the client says, okay, I'm going to send TLS hello for TLS 1.3, but here's what we're going to do. I'm going to pick Diffie-Hellman, and I'm going to start building my Diffie-Hellman parameters or RSA or whatever. And then no, you cannot use RSA for TS 1.3. So I'm going to have this information. I'm going to send my public TLS client hello with my public part of the key exchange. And it will also include the TLS, TLS encryption. I have ESNI, encrypted SNI. I have SNI. I have the server name indication. I have the HTTP2. I support HTTP2. I support HTTP1. I support all that stuff. All of this in the client hello goes. And the server will say, okay, you picked this and you picked AES as an encryption algorithm. I'm okay with that. Let's come, and I have your part now. Let's complete my other part of the key. Take the key. Now the server has the key. That's it. The server now start encrypting. So the server now has the full key, start encrypting the content, replies back with its part of the public information of the key exchange, and then replies with a server hello. Just the server hello. And that's it. With a certificate and all the things that we discussed. And we'll also say, hey, ALPN, I support H2. So let's communicate with H2. It tells you all of this stuff is just two steps. One round trip. Beautiful. So the client will now say, okay, oh, I just received a bunch of encrypted stuff. Oh, did we start encrypted already? That's fast. But there is a part that is not really encrypted, which is the public part of the keys for Diffie-Hellman. And that takes that information and then completes the pair of the key. And then now the client has the key and then they start negotiating and then they start encryption. So TLS 1.2, a little bit slow. If you're opening and closing connections, it's going to be really slow, right? Because there's a lot of going back and forth. But in the server side, in the client, in TLS 1.3, you have only one round trip. Really powerful. And not to mention, TLS 1.3 also saves power because there is less encryption to deal with, less round trip. So it's great for IoT devices. And it's perfectly forward because guess what? We don't use RSA. We don't rely on a private key. Obviously not, guys. TLS 1.3 uses ESNI, uses SNI, uses this kind of encryption. There's some of the parts of the TLS are not fully encrypted, like the server name indication that tells the server, hey, this is what the domain I want to communicate with. Serve me that particular certificate. That's not encrypted. And people, people, I mean governments and ISPs, can still look through this content and see where are you going. So the domain is a different story. The domain is still unencrypted. In the next video, maybe we're going to talk about DNS encryption, DOH, DOT, ESNI, encrypted SNI, and all of the other stuff as well. That was a long video. That was a long stream. I didn't want it to be 2 hours, but it looks like we hit almost 2 hours. Guys, what do you guys think about TLS? And I'm going to leave you right now. Have some breakfast. I hope you enjoy the live stream. We're going to do another live stream, maybe just discussing, having a little bit a casual Q&A. That would be awesome. Awesome. So, thank you so much, guys. I appreciate you. Thank you so much for your support. Thanks for everyone who is a member of this channel. And for everyone who gets my courses on Udemy. I'm moving from Udemy to another platform because I don't like Udemy as a platform. But thank you for your support. Thank you for watching the content. Thank you for everything. Thanks, Hamid, Gotcha, Anish. I appreciate you guys. I'm going to see you in the next one. You guys stay awesome. I enjoyed the stream. Thank you so much. We're going to continue this, doing this every week, hopefully, if I can. I'll let you know. I'll make sure to schedule this time. I didn't schedule for some reason. So, love you guys. I'm going to see you in the next one. You guys stay awesome. Goodbye. And make sure to check out the podcast, guys, by the way. The same content goes into the podcast, curated and edited so that they're easily consumable. All right, guys. Thank you. See you in the next one. Goodbye.